halted, stopped any dimes flowing from this fund to anybody. And they have a whole lot of bases for that. And in their 26-page decision, they talk about why they believe that the defendants, the Fearless Fund, cannot prevail. Interestingly, this was a 2-1 decision. Two of the very right-wing Trump-appointed judges made this decision. The Obama-appointed judge, and don't tell me judges don't matter, and it doesn't matter what a president does when he appoints somebody to a bench. The Obama judge, appointed judge, Rosenbaum, she writes in a 24-page decision.
Wow.
She writes, just think about that. She writes in her 22 pages, I'm sorry, decision. She writes about one issue, and that is standing. How in the world do these people have standing for 22 pages? She goes over and through how they lack standing. She starts her decision, and I just got to read it for everybody to hear. She starts it on page one saying, "No one doubts the sincerity of an Arsenal soccer player's desire to beat Tottenham. But he can't be allowed to try to win by flopping on the field, faking an injury near Tottenham's goal. For those not in the know, the object of flopping is to manufacture a foul that the player hasn't actually experienced, to manipulate the referee, and to inappropriately exercising his power to award a penalty kick in the box where it's likely to result in a goal. Referees' vigilance prevents players who have a sincere desire to defeat their opponents, but who try to do so through manufactured fouls, from commandeering referees to improperly exercise their adjudicatory authority to award unwarranted penalty kicks. Article 3 standing requirement, which comes from the Constitution's limitations on the judiciary to hear only cases and controversies, prevents the legal version of flopping."
Wow.
Okay, and it goes on.
What an amazing analogy.
Oh, she gets hotter and hotter. I mean, this is one of those. This is one of those opinions that everybody needs to read. Even if you're not a lawyer, you're going to enjoy reading this one because lays it out. So in light of that, Daryl, in light of that, I want us to talk about, what is going on with this. I've talked about what did they hold. Why is this bad law? For several reasons, folks. Not only are they just wrong on the standing issue, which is the prerequisite to having a case even heard. We're tired of these courts just saying, well, they're white, and if they say that they are injured, that's enough, without any proof. We had the same problem in the Kalis case just this year out of Louisiana, where there were these alleged whites who, non-quote, non-blacks, who were hurt by the, quote, decision to create that second majority district, and they never even had the foul declaration in their case. They just said they were injured, and the court said, fine, we agree that if you're white and you're non-black, you must be injured. I mean, this is just nonsense. These courts aren't applying legal principles. I'm sorry, Daryl, you shouldn't have gotten me going.
I know, Barbara, people need to understand what the case is all about, what the Fearless Fund case is all about. And one of the interesting things here, Terry, is that people tend to think that this is a pigeonholed case, that this fearless case will only apply to the 11th Circuit in those states, you know, around Georgia that are part of the 11th Circuit. You know, but we know that cases like this and findings like this, they spread. It's going to go across to different states. So it will not just be, you know, Georgia and other states that make up the 11th Circuit. I mean, doesn't this sort of lift up the importance of the judicial appointments and what's happening, what's at risk with these elections?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, you know, every one of your listeners should contemplate what happens when a president gets the awesome power to appoint not just Supreme Court justices, but, you know, appellate court justices and trial level justices in the federal system. It is enormous power. And as we've seen from the corruption on the part of some of the justices, there's no accountability for these people. So appointing people who actually will follow the law and apply the law, you know, in an appropriate way, that's absolutely key. We know that some presidents are willing to do that. And I will say, just look at President Biden's track record so far in appointing justices. He is the first president in a very long time, perhaps ever, to actually have diversity on the court in terms of your experience. Under presidents, Republican and Democratic, most judges and justices come from Ivy League schools. They practiced in big corporate law firms, or they were prosecutors. You very rarely have defense attorneys or you know, attorneys just representing ordinary people against corporations. Well, President Biden has changed that. He has appointed people from all walks of legal experience, and I think that makes the judiciary better. And it's really important. The president does this. You need to think carefully about who you're going to vote for president when you think about who gets to sit on these courts.
Yes.
And you know, Diane, you come from a business background. You know, and you know, and you own businesses, you've been involved in businesses, you've legislated regarding businesses. You sit back and you watch this decision. And this decision, Diane, they're taking a law, a civil rights law that was passed just after the Civil War, right? And now they're applying it to say what was meant to try to level the playing field from ignoring, blocking, or anyway, you know, interfering with blacks having access to contracts, we're now going to reverse it. We're going to say that the black folks, y'all can't block us from having contracts. Y'all can't. This law now is being used as a weapon against you rather than a shield for you. Diane, how do you respond to this?
So first, I want to just say, take us all back. During COVID, the Biden administration was really unprecedented in its focus on making sure, or attempting to make sure, that the billions of dollars that the government was putting on the table to try to save the businesses that were operating. There was a prediction at the beginning of COVID, I remember, because of the very reason you stated, Daryl, that 60% of businesses wouldn't survive. And then there was a second prediction that if it was 60 for general businesses, it would probably be 80 or 90 for black and Latino-owned businesses wouldn't survive. And on that theory and thinking, the Biden administration put together a policy that required 25%. I don't know if you remember, but that program, 25% of the monies for the small business and the emergency business loans were supposed to go to black and Latino businesses. Is it former speaker, or former DeLong out of Texas? And Miller was part of that team who challenged that program and enjoined, and the court approved an injunction. And by the time they worked through that process of the court process, the money was gone. Because predominantly white businesses were able to take it all. So this isn't new. Remember the Supreme Court case where there was never even the woman, the whole issue around, I think, Indiana, the bakery, and the fact that there wasn't even that she never tried to buy a cake or never had an order. So this isn't new, this notion of people with absolutely no standing being able to assist in the undoing of this whole fabric of protection that's been put together. The premise of the lawsuits that Barbara mentioned around admissions is that we have now reached the point where we are a race-neutral society, that we continue to overstate racism, but they now are in the process of wiping from the books any and all policies they can that were created to protect and encourage. That's what we're seeing across the board. So this is, to me, just another in a long line of what we have in place that goes to my point. They're racing now to try to destroy as much as they can, including the very system of democracy, before November of 2024. And they're doing it at every level of our court system.
Yep. And it's so important for all of us to understand that, you know, this law, the Civil Rights Act of, you know, of 1870s, that they want to use, you know, you got to understand that every time African-American progress has become substantial, the Supreme Court has been used to block it. You know, the civil rights cases are some of the most infamous cases that we study as attorneys, you know, in the United States, because they were used to block the progress of African Americans, because it said that Civil Rights Act that said that you should apply equal protection to all people, for, you know, citizens, that you should give full citizenship rights to all citizens and have equal protection of the laws to all citizens under the 14th Amendment, that law, the court held, did not apply to social and political rights, meaning that you could not use the law to force integration of public accommodations, theaters, restaurants, etc., trains, whatever, and that you couldn't use it to argue for political rights, for voting rights. You know, that was the death of Reconstruction, was that the rulings of the court in the civil rights cases. And here we go again with another court looking at African-American progress, saying we're not going to have it, and that we're okay. going to, that especially when they're becoming, you know, such a hard, you know, when you're looking at people of color becoming a new majority in this country, we're not going to have it. We're going to do everything we can to consolidate white political and social and economic power. So, folks, I just want to draw that through line for you. But let's go back and talk a little bit more about some history, because Byron Donald, oh my goodness,
representative. He's from Florida, Barbara. Remember, he's from Florida. We think yeah. they just stopped Black History last year.
Darryl!
I don't think they ever had any.
What's wrong with your brother? Yep.
Barbara, you know, I don't know what much to say about Byron Donald that's down there in Florida, but I tell you, you know, to make the insinuation that, or the assertion that Black families, you know, during Jim Crow were somehow stronger.
Yeah.
Leaves off so much, I mean, of the analysis of what's happening at the time. You know, you think of a situation where, you know, if someone let's use a real situation, Emmett Till, okay? All right, that's Jim Crow. Emmett Till's uncle, where he was living, could do nothing to stop the white men that came into the house to get him. They couldn't defend themselves.
Right.
They couldn't defend the family. So to make the mere suggestion that somehow the Black family was stronger, during that period.
I mean, I think we take it a step further. The separation.